I'm John McKay, sitting in today for Chris Board. Up next on Think, most scientists thought the discovery of new structures in the human body ended in the last century, that the body had been mapped. But in 2015, a team of researchers at the University of Virginia made a startling discovery, finding a lymphatic system for the central nervous system. Before then, the brain and the body's immune system were believed to be almost completely separate. We'll talk to the man who leads that team of researchers, Jonathan Kipnis, about that discovery and how it is leading to new ideas about treating Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, and a host of degenerative brain disorders. The conversation starts after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, where researchers strive to develop sustainable solutions to protect the world's fresh water supply. You can learn more at endeavors.tcu.edu.
From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm John McKay, sitting in today for Chris Boyd. Alzheimer's is a degenerative brain disease, the most common form of dementia, according to Alzheimer's Association of Greater Dallas. Right now, more than 360,000 people are living in Texas with Alzheimer's. Their care comes from more than 1,300 families and friends. Nationwide, a little under 6 million Americans are living with that disease. But by 2050, that number is expected to rise to 14 million. There is no cure. It is the sixth leading cause of death in the United States. So the question becomes, how do we fight Alzheimer's or other degenerative brain diseases such as Parkinson's? Discoveries of a team led by our guest today have put them on the cutting edge of that fight. Jonathan Kipnis is the University of Virginia's Harrison Distinguished Teaching Professor, and he chairs the Department of Neuroscience. He's also the director of the Center for Brain Immunology and GLIA. He joins us now from the studios of WVTF in Charlottesville, Virginia. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Scientific American magazine takes a close look at this in the cover story entitled The Seventh Sense. And I'm curious, your research and its implications, they go far beyond Alzheimer's, but I'm going to start there briefly to give us some understanding of just how groundbreaking this is. Alzheimer's, we know it's a cruel disease. The person that you see in front of you every day, they may look the same on the outside, but on the inside there are changes underway. And perhaps we should start with what it is that we know about dementia and Alzheimer's and what it does.
Well, you know, so first of all, very important, I'm not a physician, so I cannot really talk to the human disease, to the details maybe that the listeners would want to know. But the general facts, of course, we all know, and especially people who live with people who suffer from Alzheimer's, they know how devastating the disease is, as well as many other neurological disorders, like you mentioned, Parkinson's, Lou Gehrig disease, or ALS, and of course, many, many others. I think the major a promise now in the field is to detect disease in its very, very early stages, because I think we may not be able to cure it at the very late stage, but I think we hopefully will be able to delay the onset of Alzheimer's if we better understand the underlying mechanism of what's happening in the brain, or what's happening maybe even not necessarily in the brain. It could be in the periphery. It could be in the immune system. There are major changes that are happening, which then lead to problems in the brain. Once you detect problems in the brain, that becomes maybe a little bit too late. The question is, can we detect those problems before they hit the brain? So are there any peripheral changes that are happening? It could be months, or maybe years, or maybe decades before the brain actually gets impacted. So that's a very fascinating understanding that actually changing now in the field, that we need to understand what happens before it's too late.
Just about any anatomy book that people take a look at up until a few years ago showed that there was that the nervous system and the immune system, they're almost completely separate from each other. But in 2015, you published some findings that concluded that's not quite true. The brain is not completely a fortress. Can you explain that?
Yes, actually. So we've been working on these neuroimmune interactions for many, many years. I'm sure you know when we are sick, when we don't feel well, you know, we can't really solve mathematical problems, right? The brain is not functioning that well. You know, we all know this feeling of a foggy brain when we have even a common cold. So I was fascinated by this immune brain interactions. And the notion, as you said, in the field was that the two systems live completely separate lives and they only get together when there is a problem, pathology. For example, in multiple sclerosis, we have immune cells getting into the brain tissue and they attack the brain. But to us, it was a little bit against what we understand from biology because, for example, and I'm going now maybe 15, even 20 years ago back, if we're doing injury in the spinal cord, we see a very massive infiltration of immune cells from the periphery coming into the injured spinal cord, or even after traumatic brain injury, we have infiltration of immune cells. And so the notion was that these cells are doing something bad. But then we ask ourselves, why would a healing system in our body, which is the immune system, be necessarily attacking the brain? Maybe it's there to help, but it's failing, and it fails, so the degenerative process continues and maybe even becomes more exacerbated. So our initial experiments, and again, it was more than 15 years ago, we said, what if there were no immune cells after brain injury? Would the outcome really be better? And so when we did our first experiments and we published them in 2002, we showed that if you suppress or if you eliminate those immune cells that are coming after injury, actually the outcome was not better. It was actually much worse, which makes sense. You know, when you cut your finger and you have inflammation in the finger, it pains, but you know that this inflammatory response in the finger cut is very important, right? It protects you from bacteria. It heals the tissue back. And so we've showed that similar effects are also happening in the injured brain or injured spinal cord. And then from there, we ask ourselves, so this is after injury, but what happens non-injurious conditions? For example, stress. When we are stressed, do we have immune system? Is it playing any role in the brain function? So again, we are scientists, not physicians, so all the work we're doing is with animals. So our very initial studies with stress was when you take a mouse and you expose a mouse to a cat urine. And so funny enough, mice get very, very, very stressed from just smelling the cat urine. And you can check, of course, how stressed they are. And then if you test them after about a week, roughly 10 to 15% of mice will still show these long-term stress responses, which actually was developed as a model for PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. And what we notice, if we take mice without normally functional immune system, instead of 10, 15%, you will have 70, 80% of mice will develop PTSD. And so again, this was now to us showing that not only in injury, but also in stress, immune system is doing something and communicates with the brain. And then we asked the next question when I had my own lab here in Virginia. We asked, what's happening? Are immune cells also participating in the learning, in just brain function? And the answer was yes. Again, if we remove particular types of immune cells, mice cannot learn maze tasks. If we remove other types of immune cells, mice cannot socialize with each other. And so we said, if immune cells is playing such a major role in brain function, the two systems must be communicating on a daily basis. And so how this is happening? And we were looking at the borders of the brain where we have lots of immune activity. And by serendipity, a very talented postdoc in my lab, by doing stainings and looking for immune cells in those borders of the brain, realized that there are vessels which are not blood vessels, which are containing immune cells. And we said, what are these vessels? What could they be? And we tested if these are lymphatic vasculature, and indeed this was lymphatic vessels. And so now we're showing that these vessels are actually connecting the brain to the peripheral immune system. Which tells us that there is a ongoing interaction between the brain and the peripheral immune system, like it is with every other tissue.
So now, so we're talking about lymphatic vessels that, and they've escaped notice this entire time. How is that possible? Was it new technology, or was it your approach to what you were seeing?
You know, it's a great question. So after we published our paper, I received an email from an Italian colleague, and he told me, have you ever heard of Paolo Mascagni from 18th century? And I said, no, I have not heard of Paolo Mascagni from 18th century. So apparently, and it's actually a fascinating story. So there was a physician. So there was a king of Austria who actually wanted to establish a bank of human tissues or organs for medical students to learn upon. And, you know, back then you couldn't really preserve the tissue. So instead he hired this very famous Italian physician, Paolo Mascagni, and ask him to create wax models of human organs and human parts of human body. And Paolo Mascagni, together with an artist, Clemente Michelangelo Susini, were making those parts of human body and human organs. And so when they made the brain, they put a lot of lymphatic vessels on the surface of the brain coming out. And this was hugely criticized. Mascagni was discredited. And it was a big deal about those lymphatics in the brain. Now, the problem was, Mascagni was excited about, he was, if you wish, the contemporary father of lymphatic vessels. And maybe he did a little bit of exaggeration and so put a little bit more of those lymphatics in the brain that one would expect. Because there was a paper last year came out from the lab of Daniel Reich from the NIH showing the system in humans. So we know that whatever we found in mice exists in humans, and it's not as developed as Mascagni initially suggested. But nevertheless, Mascagni did notice those lymphatic vessels. So funny enough, there is a paper in a major medical journal, Lancet, in 2003, where Mascagni's anatomical excellence is being discussed, and then they also discuss four cases of, as they claim, anatomical misconception. One of those are lymphatics in the brain. And so they describe it, actually, it's very, very interesting. I don't have the quote here, but they say something like, in early 19th century, the lack of lymphatic vasculature in the brain was proved in details by some other group. And I am always bringing this quote in my lectures, and I'm asking, how can you prove a lack of something in details, right? It's really, you cannot do it. You can prove something existing in details. You cannot really prove something lack of something. But very often there is a scientific study, then there is a scientific study that negates the initial findings. And we as a scientific community today, and I guess also 200 years ago, we tend to go with those who question the initial findings and maybe discredit the initial discoverers. And so what happened is for over 200 years, this major finding of lymphatic vessels in the brain was actually somehow ignored. And interestingly enough, there were several publications in the mid-90s, claiming that there is maybe a lymphatic drainage from the brain. But again, those works were completely dismissed by contemporaries. So in our case, of course, you know, science moves in an exceptionally fast pace. And so what is happening is, for example, if you're going into lymphatic vessels 20 years ago, the only way to detect lymphatic vessels was by electron microscopy, because lymphatic vessels look very different from blood vessels. But today we can do it by electron microscopy, what we had many years ago, but we also have some other more precise tools. And so, of course, when we were doing it with the more precise tools, we were able to detect those vessels to a level of preciseness that, you know, nobody can argue against their existence. But luckily, we did not know about those old works, because had we knew about them, you know, we probably wouldn't even bother to look there. We were looking into this area of brain coverings just because we realized that something is happening, something is going on, there must be communication. Let's see what's happening there.
So, you know, in other parts of the body, the lymphatic system, I believe it clears the waste and the bacteria away. When you were looking at all this, did it look like that was the same case with the brain with regard to the communication between the two?
Also, I'm always giving this example. It may sound a little gross to the listeners, but I'll give it. Think if somebody is going to look through your household garbage for a day, a week, 2 weeks. They will know about you so much, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Just by looking through what you're throwing away. So same thing, that's the same way lymphatic system operates. It takes not only bacteria, like you said, of course, if there is an infection in a tissue, that will be a major thing to deliver, but it takes all the garbage that the tissue produces and takes it through the lymph nodes. And the lymph nodes are, if you wish, the command centers of the immune system. And so immune cells are sitting in those lymph nodes and are basically going through the garbage that comes out from the tissue. Mm. And all they look is everything okay? Because the moment you have infection in the tissue, or you have inflammation in the tissue, or you have a tumor in the tissue, immune system detects that there is something different. This is a bacterial infection. This is a viral infection. Here is something, you know, something gross going on. Maybe it's an aging tissue, maybe there's a tumor in the tissue, and so immune system responds to those changes.
Let me take a short break here real quick. We'll come back because this is the part that I really find fascinating, all this. This is John McKay sitting in today for Chris Boyd. Now, we're talking with Dr. Jonathan Kipnis, University of Virginia, about links his research team has discovered between the nervous system and the immune system and its potential impact on the treatment of all sorts of diseases. We'll continue our discussion after a short break. You're listening to Think. I'm John McKay, sitting in today for Chris Boyd. We are talking to Jonathan Kipnis, University of Virginia, about links that his research team has discovered between the nervous system and the immune system. And he is explaining for us right now how in the brain, lymphatic vessels are doing about the same thing that they do in other parts of the body. Can you go ahead and explain to us how this is working? Because it's really, we're talking about almost like a sewer system, I would imagine.
Oh, it is absolutely a sewer system of the tissue. Yes, definitely. It's a sewer system of the tissue that removes, like I said, all the garbage the tissues produce into the lymph nodes. So the lymphatic vessels are, if you wish, the highway through which all the sewage is going, or the pipes of the sewage. It goes all the way into the centers, the lymph nodes, and that's where the immune system is sitting and looking at what comes out of the tissue. And if they detect some change from the homeostatic signature of the tissue, then they respond and they go back into the tissue. Normally, immune cells go back to the tissue with the blood vessels. And by the way, they come out of the tissue also with lymphatic vessels. So the lymphatic vessels are carrying two things. They're carrying the waste of the tissue and the immune cells from the tissue. So in the brain, it seems like they're doing exact same thing. And therefore, it is potentially fascinating to propose that maybe with the aging, there is some removal, if the signature of the tissue changes because the neurons start to die or because there are some more abrupt changes happening in the brain, the immune system may detect that there is some problem, there is some change from there's a deviation from homeostasis. And so the immune system may then decide to go back into the brain in an attempt to fix the problem. Now, will the immune system always be able to fix the problem? No, right? We know when we are sick and we have a bacterial infection, we take antibiotics. We don't rely entirely on our immune system. Without antibiotics, people were dying like flies. So this is something to help immune system, of course, to kill the bacteria, so to help the immune system fight the problem. And maybe very similar things are happening in our degenerating brain. Immune system is coming to help, but it's failing to do the job precisely. Now, there are several ways, of course, to look at it. Maybe we can boost immune activity. Can we create something that I don't want to say a vaccine, but something that an immune booster that will allow immune cells to go to the, for example, injured or degenerating brain and be active there more efficiently? These are all speculations right now. So I think the research is still very much in its infancy, but there are some very, very promising work. For example, there was a wonderful paper from, going back to Alzheimer's, there is a wonderful paper from UC Irvine group that showed that if you take a mice on Alzheimer's mouse models and you prevent those immune cells getting into the brain in the beginning of the disease, the disease will develop much faster.
Now, I want to get back to Alzheimer's for just a second. My understanding is that some of the concerns have to do with the fact that there's a buildup of proteins, and that. But the question is, with those proteins, is I guess they will result in the degeneration of your cognitive abilities. So the question is, can those lymphatic vessels are they supposed to be moving that protein out of your brain? And is that the problem?
You're asking great questions. So actually, we just had a paper published also now in August, and it will require a little bit of explanation, some kind of background. So brain meat, we call it brain parenchyma. It does not contain lymphatic vasculature, lymphatic vessels inside the brain itself. So the lymphatic vessels are sitting on top of the brain. So far from what we know, this is the only organ that has this unique structure where the lymphatic vessels are on the surface, not inside the tissue. But how is the brain? But brain is also produces a lot of waste, right? It's a very active organ. So how is the brain, if you wish, how is the brain drained? How is the brain being washed through? And so the brain swims within a fluid, which is called cerebral spinal fluid, or the CSF. And there was a wonderful group of scientists, and the principal investigator there is Maiken Niedergaard, and she is in the University of Rochester. And so what Maiken's group showed is that this fluid that flows around the brain can go into the brain through these, if you wish, channels. And she called those channels glymphatics, not the lymphatics, because they are not lymphatic vasculature. They are like the channel-like structures through which water goes in and then washes through the brain. Okay?
Okay.
And then it removes all the waste from the brain and then gets back into this fluid in which the brain flows, and then that fluid is being removed through our lymphatic vessels that are in the surface. Now, what we showed in our recent paper that if you ablate those lymphatic vessels in the surface of the brain, the whole wash of the brain is being impaired. And that will result in accumulation of amyloid beta. So it's a very complex, if you wish, water circulation through the brain. And if you impair any of the steps on its way, you will have a problem with the clearance and accumulation of the amyloid. Now, what's really fascinating, and listeners probably know that many of Alzheimer's patients have sleep problems. And we know that during sleep time, actually, the amyloid is cleared more efficiently from the system. Maiken Niedergaard showed that her glymphatic system is working primarily at night during the sleep time. So that's when the brain clears itself. And so that just tells you how important the sleep is. Now, immune system is also more functioning during sleep time, and therefore the lymphatic vessels are better working during sleep time. So when we're going to bed and we're going to sleep, our brain drainage is just working much more efficiently and removes the fluid and along it all the waste material like amyloid beta out into the periphery. But of course, with aging, even if we sleep well, the lymphatic vasculature is deteriorating with their function, and so this entire system is kind of failing.
Fascinating. It's just so fascinating to me. So I want to make sure I've got this right. So if we have these this amyloid beta, is this something we've always had and it's just now and it's just accumulating as we get older, or is this something that's being introduced as we get older and it causes a problem?
No, so amyloid beta is produced everywhere in the body, not only in the brain.
Okay.
It somehow accumulates only in the brain.
Okay.
Potentially because we have very poorly, even though we have lymphatic vessels in the periphery of the brain, it's still not very maybe efficient in its clearance. But remember also, we today live longer than we were supposed to live, right? If you think evolutionary. And so I just think that everything is going south when we age. And the question is, can we extend healthy aging? I think this is the number one question. And there are some beautiful works. There's a lab of Tony Weiss-Curry from Stanford, which are actually showing that you can extend healthy aging.
So now, is the problem then the vessels themselves, that they're not functioning properly, or is it something else that we're seeing right now? Because I know that you've taken a careful look at the vessels and how as we get older, how they're affected.
Yeah, so again, everything is done in mice, and what we're showing that in aged mice, the vessels become narrower and they are not draining as efficiently. And what we can do is we can take young mouse, which is predisposed to Alzheimer's, but will not have Alzheimer's until it's getting old. And if in this young mouse we destroy the vessels, then we will start seeing accumulation of amyloid beta very, very early, which tells us that lymphatic vessels, they may not be the cause for A beta accumulation, but they probably one of the causes. Because again, in young mice, if we destroy those vessels, we start seeing accumulation, which we wouldn't see there otherwise.
Well, I know that you've also taken a look at these vessels, and that your research shows that you can introduce a compound sometimes in the mice, and you will notice an improvement in their cognitive ability. Is that right?
Yes. So the question was, it was a little bit crazy, if you wish, and my postdoc was very resistant doing the experiment because he thought it would never work. So again, you can assess how well the brain is being washed through. You can just put a marker in this fluid and then see how quickly it gets in and gets out. So in old mice, this process is very, very impaired. And we said, if lymphatic vessels really controlling this passage of the fluid through the brain, we can fix lymphatic vessels. That's been done in the periphery by many labs. So there is a growth factor, which is unique for lymphatic endothelial cells. So we apply it we're shaving the skull and we're putting it in this kind of sort of a gel, if you wish. Maybe in the future, we were joking, maybe it will be a shampoo. So we're applying this gel with this growth factor and for about a month. And so what happens is this growth factor actually trickles into the borders of the brain, interacts with lymphatic endothelial cells, and makes them grow. So the vessel becomes kind of rejuvenated. It becomes wider, and it drains the fluid better. And we were really amazed because now when we put the same tracer in the fluid, it actually will go through the brain much more efficiently. And then we said, of aged mice. Mm-hmm. And then we said, okay, now we can take aged mouse, we put this growth factor, and we recover the flow through the brain almost to the level of the young mouse. Do we also change the cognitive function of these mice? And we were very surprised when we tested those aged mice, which usually perform very, very poorly on cognitive tasks. But after treatment with this growth factor, they actually were much, much better than their controls. And so this is, as far as I know, is maybe the first time that we're definitely showing, or that we know, that you can actually affect something which is peripheral to the brain, if you wish, not even neurons, right? We are affecting lymphatic vessels, and we're showing improvement in cognitive function.
So now we've been talking a little bit about Alzheimer's, but this also has some implications for, say, Parkinson's and multiple sclerosis. Is that right? Long term is what I'm talking.
Well, multiple sclerosis, of course, it's a very different disease. In multiple sclerosis, what you have is you have uncontrolled infiltration of immune cells into the brain.
Okay.
And so actually, multiple sclerosis is a very unique disease because actually, unlike any other neurological disorder, it has, I think, 13 FDA-approved treatments. Drugs, and some of them are extremely efficient. So I think MS is probably, it's definitely the outlier of neurological disorders. In Parkinson's, what we need to understand is what is the cause in the disease. So the more heterogeneous the disease is, the more difficult, of course, it will be to find one thing that will address them all. But I believe that if it's a systemic disease of the brain, we need to then develop a systemic approach. And the immune system and the lymphatic system, those are the systems, right? And so I believe that targeting those will give us some answers. And also remember, it's much easier to target the immune system or the lymphatic system than targeting the brain. The brain itself and the neurons, they're sitting behind this fortress, if you wish, called blood-brain barrier, very hard to deliver molecules into the brain. And even if you do, you don't know really exactly how much and when and how often. The immune system is very unique because you can even replace immune system, right? You can do bone marrow transplantation and replace the entire immune system. You can really target the lymphatic vessels. You can maybe regenerate and rejuvenate it. So I think those peripheral systems, they may not give you, I don't want to mislead the listeners, I don't think they will cure diseases. But what my lab is fascinated about is just to extend a healthy aging for longer than our lifespan, and then it'll be good.
You're listening to Think. I'm John McKay, and today for Chris Boyd, we're talking to Jonathan Kipnis of the University of Virginia about some of the implications, the long-term implications for his research, his and his team's research on the communication between the nervous system and the immune system. And so now, what I'm amazed about this is number one, you've actually gone back and taken a look at the previous research that apparently was lost, some of the observations, I should say, and you're trying to apply this to other things. We've talked about Parkinson's, we've talked about Alzheimer's. How about our own behavior? Do you think that in general, these kinds of things that you're taking a look at could affect the behavior of everyone? Their personality?
Well, so in 2016, we published a very interesting paper where we showed that a particular molecule coming from the immune cells can actually change a social behavior in mice.
Really?
Yes. Which, if you wish, it's quite interesting. But let's think about it. Let's think whether it's realistic or not. And
okay.
Let's maybe go back when we were maybe single cell organisms or maybe multiple cell organisms, right? So the immune system is there to protect us, of course, from the pathogen, right?
Yes.
So if just the hypothesis, if two organisms want to start communicating with each other and get into social interactions, they would probably want to make sure that they would not die from each other pathogens.
Correct.
So they would need to develop a strong immune response to allow them to communicate. And during the years, if two systems are co-developing together, then they will be using a very similar signaling in molecules. And so what we showed is the molecule that we knew, it's called interferon gamma. The molecule that we knew is a major molecule to fight pathogens. For example, I don't know in humans, but in mice, if you don't have interferon gamma, mice will die from flu and from many other infections. And I'm sure it will also probably apply for humans. In this exact molecule, we always thought was immune molecule because it's produced by immune cells and it targets immune cells. What we found is that the receptor for the molecule is also expressed on particular types of neurons. And these neurons happen to sit in a circuit which controls social behavior. And so when there is no signaling through these neurons by this molecule, neurons misbehave, a whole circuit misbehaves, and then we see a behavior which is a lack of social preference.
Hmm.
So interestingly enough, there was a paper last year by another group in Nature that showed actually that another molecule, another what we called a classic immune molecule called interleukin 17, they all numbered from 1 to you name it. So interleukin 17, which is a very major immune molecule to target our enteric infections. So this molecule apparently works on neurons in a very primitive organism, C. elegans, and actually is able to change their response, the sensory neurons. Later on, last year, was another beautiful paper by a group in MIT, Gloria Choi's lab, and they showed that the same molecule, interleukin 17, maternal interleukin 17, targets neurons in developing embryos, the neurons, not the immune system, but the neurons in the brain, and then changes the structure of that area of the brain, which also involved in social interactions. And so the mice which are born with autism-like behaviors. So here we're looking how immune signaling, immune molecules, are affecting the brain and changing the brain function.
I'm John McKay, sitting in today for Chris Boyd. We're talking with Dr. Jonathan Kipnis, the University of Virginia. He's our guest today, discussing the links his research team has discovered between the nervous system and the immune system. I'm going to take a short break here. Stay with us. Listening to Think, I'm John McKay, sitting in today for Chris Boyd. We're talking with Jonathan Kipnis, the University of Virginia, about links his research team has discovered between the nervous system and the immune system. And we're talking about the potential impact of that discovery on really all of us. There is a fascinating cover story in this month's edition of Scientific American. Doctor, you were getting into the fact, you were discussing the fact before the break, that what you're looking at and what you've been seeing in terms of mice, if you looked at the rest of us and you found the same results, our entire behavior, our personality could be changed with just a few changes in what you're seeing.
Well, but even though it sounds very surprising, but think of a sick child, not sick, just a common cold. They usually, you know, they usually want to be hugged. They usually want to be, they become, if you wish, maybe more social. Think of an adult who is this maybe similar common cold. Usually people show more withdrawal behavior, right? All you want is to get into the bed and not to be in a dark room and not to be touched by anybody. So, I mean, we do behave very differently when we have infections. So this is nothing new. And these works have been shown many years ago by wonderful groups. Actually, there is a common name to it. It's called the sickness behavior. And we know that the sickness behavior is mediated by immune molecules. What we were asking is, why are these cytokines affecting the brain? How are these cytokines affecting the brain? And then when we came to this, if you wish, interesting idea that we kind of termed the seventh sense. So what is our brain? Our brain is a computing machine, right? We have our five senses. And then we also know where we are in the space, the proprioception. So we have our six senses, if you wish. What it does is actually we get all our senses deliver information from the peripheral world into our brain, and the brain computes our actions. So if you see a lion, you will run, right? If you smell something is burning, you will either run or try to extinguish the fire, right? So, I mean, that's what our brain does. And so the question was very simple. We as organisms are living in the world of microorganisms. They live everywhere around us, and as listeners know, they also live within us. Today, the microbiome, everybody knows about it, right? We have more bacterial cells in our body than we have our human cells. So the question that I ask myself, is it really conceivable that the brain gave up on the notion of even, you know, identifying or knowing what bacteria are within us, what bacteria are outside us, not bacteria, microorganisms in general, and what happens when they invade us, the pathogenic microorganisms. And if it's not conceivable that the brain would give up on such important information, then you would say, how does then brain detect those microorganisms? On the other hand, we have this immune system in our organism, which has been evolved to an amazing precision of detecting microorganisms. Really, so you could have two different subtypes of the flu strain, and your immune system will know exactly which one is which. The precision is absolutely exceptional. And so what I suggested is, could it be that the immune system is there to sense the microorganisms and then inform the brain about them? And that's why I gave it, it was just, you know, just for us to kind of discuss it as a concept, I gave it a seventh sense. But the editors of Scientific American really liked it, and so they put it as a title of the article. This is so right now, even though there is some evidence from other labs and there is some evidence from my lab, but this is right now it's just a concept. If you wish, this is a working kind of a framework. But it's something that, you know, it just makes sense. Even if I tell it to my kids or you know, my friends who are non-scientists, it just makes sense.
I understand that for a while you wanted to be the doctor that cured cancer.
Well, so I come from a family of physicians. Mm-hmm. So I remember myself, a little kid, wanting to cure cancer. I was actually worried that by the time I grow up and go through all my training, cancer will be cured, and so I will not be able to, you know, to contribute to cancer treatment. And then I started my graduate school in Weizmann Institute in Israel, and actually I was in one of the really probably the best cancer labs there. I was very lucky to get accepted. But I came to it was an open house, and this, if you wish, crazy professor from neurobiology was giving a talk, and I just fell in love with her presentation and with her science. I went and talked to her. Her name is Michal Schwartz. I went to talk with her after the lecture, and since then I never left the field. And she was the pioneer of this neuroimmune interactions in a more positive way of not seeing how immune system damages the brain, but more understanding why is there immune system in the injured brain and what is it doing there, and could it be that at least some of the effects are actually beneficial?
Now, the research that you're working on right now, you really moved into this idea, I understand, as a graduate student.
So as a graduate student, as I said, I was working in a lab that was interested in the role of immune system on injured brain. And so from this, as I said in the beginning, from this immune system responding to injured brain, I asked myself, will it also be relevant to a non-injured? So went into stress, and then went into just learning and memory and social behavior. And so kind of developed myself into this more, if you wish, homeostatic interactions between the immune system and the brain without injury, even though we're also continuing some work on CNS injury.
So now, what's next in your research?
So no, the seventh sense, like I said, this is just the concept, and I would like to either prove or disprove this hypothesis. And so we are actually looking there now. We're trying to understand how different immune molecules affecting different brain regions and different behaviors. And why is it happening? Can we interfere? Can we target the immune system and change different behaviors? And of course, on the aspect of neurodegeneration, like I said, is understanding what are the changes that are happening in the immune system and lymphatic system very early, before Alzheimer's disease starts. Can we detect those changes and maybe interfere to actually slow down the progression, but even better, to delay, to postpone the onset of the disease?
We've talked today about Alzheimer's. We've talked about other concerns that people have. Even talked about all of us, our own behavior, our personality. You see this continuing on to other fields?
Well, in terms of treatment, you know, like I said, if we can take aged mice, very, very old mice, two-year-old mouse probably equals to 85, 90-year-old human. Mice normally live in our facility no more than 2.5, maybe 3 years at most. So 2-year-old mouse is a very, very old mouse. If we take a 2-year-old mouse and we can treat them with this growth factor, which targets lymphatic vessels and improve their cognition, I think it's very promising. You know, it will be a long time to go from there into a human therapy. But what we're doing is we're taking out those lymphatic endothelial cells from mice and also from humans, from healthy and from different diseases. We're trying to sequence them. Today, of course, there is amazing technologies which are developing. So we're trying to sequence them and to understand what are the changes that are happening in those cells. Can we predict something and can we find targets which would actually be amenable for therapeutic intervention?
You've pointed to, we talked earlier about the technology and its implications and how it helps with the research, but you have also mentioned that collaboration of different research disciplines really helps in developing what the results that you've come to.
Absolutely. You know, so I am really lucky because you interview me about my findings, and I know people listen to me, and I get those emails from wonderful people telling me about their stories. You know, it's fascinating, right? And I always share it with my lab members, especially those who are part of the findings, and also with collaborators. But people need to understand that science is not about what I am doing. And we would never be able to find those lymphatic vessels if the markers for lymphatic endothelial cells wouldn't be in place. And these are the small bricks on which the foundation of science is being built. You know, these people don't, unfortunately, get called on NPR because what they do will not be of interest to a general audience. But without their contribution, the science would be today nowhere. And I think this is a really exciting part of American science, right? Especially in America, because I think here in this country, the basic science is hugely appreciated. And without this, I don't think we can make any progress. The basic science is up. Sometimes people, people who are not scientists, they would ask me, you know, what you're doing is really important, but these other people, this is like too basic. They're working on flies. Yeah, they're working on flies, but they are finding the circuits, the basic circuits of how brain works. Without those works on flies, we would never be able to make any progress on mice, and without those, of course, and of course in humans. So the basic science is absolutely fundamental for us as society and for us as for the benefit of the humankind. And then for collaboration, you know, today you cannot. I don't think there is any major advance that is made today which is a one-man show. And if you go back, if you go 30, 40, 50 years back, you would find papers with a single author, maybe with two authors. And today, on our recent papers, I counted, there are 7 labs which have been involved, 7 labs. Another paper is coming out. I think there is 8 or 9 labs involved there. And everybody contributes something which is very, very unique to that lab. For example, we collaborated with engineers who are doing all the beautiful brain imaging. We would have never been able to do it. Or we're collaborating with people who are looking at the blood vasculature function in our BME department. We would have never been able to do it. Or we collaborate with other people who make these gels with this unique molecule so we can apply it to mice. So scientific collaboration is fundamental. And basic science, even though general audience doesn't understand the importance of it, because again, it's very hard to deliver this excitement to people about some very basic findings. Without it, we would not be able to make any major advances as well.
You're listening to Think. I'm John McKay, in today for Chris Boyd. We're talking with Jonathan Kipnis, University of Virginia. When you're talking, explaining this to the general public, what is the one thing that you think that people need to walk away with when you're talking about your research and its implications that probably in interviews we're missing?
I was quite amazed. You covered it very, very well. I think that people need to, if there was a couple of messages that I would like to deliver, like I said, we need to continue and support basic science. We need to continue and support those bricks that are building the foundation of research. We're making not only my lab, as a scientific community, we're making major progress in the recent years. I think the science is moving in absolutely amazing pace. It will, of course, take time from the animal research to humans. You know, we should be very, very careful. We can cure many diseases in mice, but not necessarily everything translates into humans. So the translation piece is very, very difficult and very, very complex, because people may not know, but mice that we work with are all identical, like identical twins. And we do it just to reduce the diversity and to be able to actually control at least some of the factors. Humans are all different. So we need to understand, but when you go down to the very, very, very basic mechanisms, those are most probably usually translate from mice to humans. So it takes time. There are many, many major discoveries right now that are coming out. And of course, everybody wants them to be immediately applicable to the diseases of their dears and no dear ones. And it will not be immediately. It will take time. But I've been in a couple of meetings in the last couple of weeks, and I think the entire scientific community is quite optimistic that things are going to change. And I think we will be able to, again, if not maybe cure at the very late stage, we will be able to hopefully delay or slow down progression of major neurological disorders, which today the most challenging disorders are the disorders of the brain.
Great news, too, is also that your research has progressed to the point. I understand that you've now signed a deal with a prominent medical company to take a look at some of the applications of the research that you're working on.
Yeah, because like I said, we cannot do translation in the lab. So we sign a deal with the company who are actually experts in translating those basic findings into hopefully clinical implications, and so they will be doing their work, and I'll be just advising them, and it's very exciting. I am really looking forward to see what comes.
Thank you so very much for spending some time with us today, Jonathan Kipnis. We appreciate you very much. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
He is the University of Virginia's Harrison Distinguished Teaching Professor. He chairs the Department of Neuroscience, is also director of the Center for Brain Immunology and Glia, where he still leads a team of researchers who discovered a link between the brain and the body's immune system. Think is produced by Stephen Becker. Alan Roberts was on the board for us today. Samantha Guzman is associate producer. Jeff Whittington's executive producer. You can follow us on Twitter at KERATHINK. Use any podcast app to get the Think podcast, or go to our website, think.kera.org. I'm John McKay, sitting in today for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.